ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
A king stands tall, looking regal. On his head, you've got a big crown glittering with diamonds. His arm is outstretched, holding a scepter. And draped over his shoulders are, of course, his royal robes. They're trimmed with fur, they trail on the ground, and of course, the colour is a deep, rich purple.
It's very much a status symbol and has been, you know, since the earliest records that we have. There are indications that colour was important to people, that it played a role in status.
Today, purple is everywhere. It's one of the colours linked to gay pride, of gender equality, of wizards. But that wasn't always the case.
I feel like the democratisation of colour is something that is a wonderful thing, and it leads to this great bravery and freedom. But there's also been negative consequences.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how a teenager accidentally invented purple as we know it, how it revolutionised fashion and power, and no one saw it coming.
So my mother was a florist, and I have very early memories of going to day school in London, which is where I was born and where I grew up. And on the way back from school, we would stop off in her flower shop while she closed up the store. And while she was doing all the things that she needed to shut the shop down, she would kind of give me the flowers that hadn't quite made it into the bouquets that day to occupy myself. So I would be given kind of like the slightly daggy ones, or the ones that for whatever reason weren't long enough, the stems weren't long enough. And I would kind of mess around with those and make little bouquets.
So this is Cassia St. Clair.
I'm a writer, and I'm the author of The Secret Lives of Colour and The Golden Thread.
And those little bouquets that Cassia was making would transform into pocket money.
I was a total sucker because I definitely believed that people were buying my bouquets, and that was definitely not happening. But that process of kind of putting together different colours and making colour combinations, I do think really stuck with me. And she was a very visual and creative person. But then when I got to university, I became interested in colour more academically because it was coming up a lot in my research. I was looking at women's dress during the long 18th century, and colour was something that came up a lot when people were talking about the costumes they were making for masquerade balls, fabrics and dyes and what they wanted to look like. And there was this colour vocabulary that I found really interesting.
Phrases like pea green or sky blue, for example.
But there were other colours that I didn't know what they looked like, and they weren't familiar terms anymore. And I was fascinated that these had been so obvious to everyone at the time, and then they disappeared. And sometimes you could relatively easily find out what those colours looked like, but sometimes it was almost impossible. You would really struggle to find visual references because the colour had been fashionable for such a short time that it hadn't made it into many things like portraits or other visual media. And sometimes the visual media has disappeared or degraded over time. And so you would just be left with the colour name and maybe a description, or maybe the word was French and you could look up and guess what it might look like. But sometimes, you know, you just had no idea what that colour term was. And I found that really fascinating. And I love the kind of the treasure hunt of that.
So, to understand the life of these colours, and particularly our regal purple, you actually need to go back to the 1800s. And life was, well, in London, it was very grey.
So the mid-19th century in London is a really busy, dirty, exciting time. In fact, London is expanding massively at this point. There's this huge shift in society. Loads of people are moving to cities from the countryside and having to start again, get new jobs, and figure out a new way of living. The textile industry is booming, and this has really sort of powered the Industrial Revolution. So lots and lots of people work in the textile industry.
If you were to look around and look at what other people were wearing, they were probably wearing quite drab clothes. There was very little colour at all.
There is this very old and very traditional way of seeing colour, which was that colours that were bright and colour fast and eye-catching were, to a greater extent, really reserved for finer fabrics and for wealthier people. So you would quite easily be able to tell someone's social class from the textiles that they're wearing at quite a big distance. So colours like bright reds, bright purples, you know, really saturated colours would indicate someone who has quite a lot of money. And you'd probably also see that just in the texture of the cloth they're wearing, because there was no point having beautiful cloth and then dyeing it a colour that didn't indicate wealth. So, you know, beautiful, lustrous cloth would be dyed bright, saturated colours.
So colour is already a status symbol.
It's very much a status symbol and has been, you know, since the earliest records that we have. There are indications that colour was important to people, that it played a role in status. The very earliest fibres that we know human beings ever made, they're already dyed a range of colours, and they're 34,000 years old. So there's already this indication that people were thinking about colour and using colour as a way to differentiate themselves.
And who, especially, would want to differentiate themselves from others? Royalty.
Particularly in the West, the colour that comes up most often when you talk about royalty is purple. And this has, again, a very kind of ancient origin, because in the ancient world, dating back to about the 15th century BC, there was a very specific, very beautiful dye that was made from two different types of mollusks that are native to the Mediterranean. And this purple dye was really just beloved of the ancient world, particularly the parts that circled the Mediterranean. It was a very saturated colour. It was darker, I think, than we think of royal purple now. The descriptions that you have of it from writers like Pliny describe it as being like clotted blood, which isn't a very appealing colour to us now. But to them, that seemed to really indicate kind of power and status.
Yes, so this colour came from mollusks. So basically, we're talking about things like sea slugs, and the process was, he was involved.
These had to be caught, and then the shells would be cracked open, and the kind of raw mollusk mixture would be left to ferment in the sun. And not only are you dealing with rotting mollusks, you're also then dealing with sources of alkaline in order to kind of to make and fix the dye to cloth. And the most readily available source of alkaline at the time was stale urine. So you've got the mixture, the potent mixture of stale urine and rotting mollusks. It seems incredible to us now, but these really disgusting ingredients come together and create a really saturated, deep purple colour that very quickly becomes incredibly expensive, very sought after, and becomes a kind of visual shorthand, a very potent visual shorthand for power and wealth. So much so, rules and legislation is passed forbidding certain people from wearing it.
So highly sought after colour that becomes sort of coated with wealth. It's inaccessible to most people, but there is a person who's about to enter this story. In fact, pretty much a teenager who's about to enter this story that changes all of that. Introduce me to young William Perkin. Who is he?
Yeah, so William Henry Perkin is born in London, in kind of the East End of London, in 1838. And he comes from a fairly humble background. His father is a builder, and his father's great desire for his son is that he become an architect. So same kind of industry, but the next kind of level up. So that's the aspiration that he has for his son. But from a fairly young age, it is clear that William Henry Perkin's is fascinated by chemistry. And it's clear that Perkins has a real aptitude for it. He really enjoys it. He loves it. And so from his mid-teenage years, it already seems that his path has been set. And from this this school, he is introduced to another chemist who is working in London, a man called Hoffman. And Hoffman is really interested in a problem of creating a synthetic variant of quinine.
So remember, we are in the age of empires. The British Empire in particular, it is strong and far-reaching. One of the biggest challenges is to avoid disease in order to maintain power. And the disease that everyone is particularly keen to avoid is malaria.
It's really bad in a lot of the colonies that these countries have, but it's also, you know, a problem, frankly, in Europe as well. And there's only really one cure or preventative that people are aware of at the time, and that comes from a tree that is native to South America. It's expensive, you have to transport it over and get it across the world. And it is clear to chemists at the time that if you could make a synthetic version of quinine, it would be incredibly lucrative. And it would probably also, if you're canny and thinking about it this way, it would probably also be a kind of key to power and success, because if, you know, you would be a great contributor to empire and imperial wealth and rule.
And so with that in mind, Hoffman is dedicated to producing synthetic quinine.
And Perkin becomes his lab assistant. Not only is Perkin working with Hoffman in the lab in the school in London, he is also kind of taking his homework home with him. And he is working in a kind of makeshift laboratory. Some reports say that the laboratory is in the garden of his father's house, and some people say it's in the attic. But either way, there's not much equipment.
Now, Perkins is kind of just messing around in his makeshift lab, trying to make a synthetic quinine, which should be a colourless liquid.
And he ends up instead, he's working with a substance called coal tar, which is a byproduct of the kind of new kinds of lighting. It's, you know, it's essentially an extract of fossil fuels. It's becoming more and more abundant as people find more and more uses for fossil fuels at the time. And so chemists are fascinated with it. And this is why he's working on an extract of coal tar.
And then something happens. What looks like a failed experiment turns out to be history-making, because rather than a colourless liquid, which was what he was hoping for, young William Perkin ends up with a dark brown sludge.
But he decides, rather than just throwing it away, he's going to keep on playing around with it. He's going to try some other experiments on this sort of unpromising sludge. And in the course of one of these experiments, what he ends up with is a bright purple liquid. Again, not what he's looking for. And again, another chemist, maybe an older one, maybe one a more focused one, maybe a more jaded one, perhaps. Again, probably would have thrown that away and started again, but he doesn't. He's curious. And so he dips a piece of cloth into this purple solution, and out comes a brilliantly dyed purple piece of cloth. And he does tests on it. He puts it next to a window to see if the light will fade it. And this is something that's a real problem with dyes at the time. You spend a few sunny days outside and suddenly all the colour is bleached from your dress or your coat. But he quickly sees that actually this isn't a problem with this new dye that he's created, that actually it's really colour fast and light fast. And he washes it and the colour remains. And he thinks, I'm onto something here. I've created something new and exciting. This is a dye that can be created in a lab, and that has huge commercial potential. Most people might be like, okay, this is interesting. I'll put it to one side and I'll come back to this. But fundamentally, my ticket out of here is through quinine and through this personal relationship I have with a pretty well-known chemist who's taken me under his wing. He's made me his lab assistant. I should be focusing on the problem that he set me. But that's not what Perkin does. Hoffman is not particularly impressed by this discovery and is not, you know, delighted that his student wants to sort of strike off on his own. And yet Perkin persists.
And so Perkin kind of becomes his own ambassador. Like, he really believes in his purple dye. And even though he has no background in dyeing, no knowledge of the industry or how it works, dude just starts spreading the news.
he starts writing these letters off to various people. He gets in touch with Dyer's works up in Scotland, near Glasgow, and he also gets in touch with some other dyers who are based in London in Bethnal Green. But fundamentally, he's also got this entrepreneurial spirit. So within 6 months of doing this experiment, finding this dye, he has already applied for and received a patent for his invention. And he sets up a company with his father and his brother. He persuades his father to invest all his savings in creating a factory near, building a factory near Harrow, and away they go. They've started a company. So it's really, you know, it's based on some encouragement from some traditional dyers, but most of the industry was not interested. They had their established supply chains, they had their way of doing things, they had their expertise, and they weren't really interested in some newfangled experiment by someone who had nothing to do with the industry, making a colour in a lab. It seemed crazy and they wanted nothing to do with it. So he managed to find two people who were interested, but fundamentally he wanted to kind of strike off on his own and create his own dye works.
It takes a few years, but eventually Perkins' factory is a success. And really, it's mostly thanks to two royals who choose to wear his purple because, I guess like influencers these days, they turn heads and they started a craze.
The first of whom, Empress Eugenie, is renowned for having eyes that are very peculiar shade of blue. They're sort of almost got a sort of a purple cast to them. And she decides that she really likes the look of this new bright purple dye because she believes it kind of brings out the colour of her eyes, and she wears it to an event in 1857, and this gets a little bit of attention. And the following year, Queen Victoria wears it to the wedding of her daughter. Essentially, two people who people pay a lot of attention to wear Perkins' purple, which is by this time called mauve, and mauve takes off. And Perkin is the only one making it. He's the only one who has the wherewithal to make it. It's not an easy colour to replicate through natural means. So Perkins essentially has cornered the market in purple.
So there is this sort of purple mania that takes over. And is it true that Charles Dickens references Perkins' purple?
Yeah, it's something that contemporaries are really aware of. So Punch magazine, which is a kind of satirical British magazine, they run an article talking about everyone catching the mauve measles. And there is this incredible quote by Charles Dickens, who was actually a man who could be prey himself to a colour craze. But he says, he writes, "As I look out my window, the apotheosis of Perkins' purple seems at hand. Purple hands wave from open carriages. Purple hands shake each other at street doors. Purple hands threaten each other from opposite sides of the street. Purple striped gowns cram barouches, jam up cabs, throng streamers, fill railway stations, all flying countryward, like so many migrating birds of purple paradise."
But creeping up behind the purple haze is a multicoloured cloud because other dyers are figuring out Perkins' methods and they start making other coloured dyes.
Perkins creates his mauve, but very soon afterwards, it's found that this technology, this kind of coal tar, can produce a whole range of other colours. There's a whole family of aniline dyes that come onto the market incredibly quickly. Greens, yellows, purples, blues, blacks. And you have this explosion of colour, of very bright colours, colours that can be mixed together, and also colours that are not bound by the same rules of material scarcity. So before, a few colours were very expensive because they were made from rare natural materials. But now you can create this rainbow of bright colours in a lab, and so you can mix and match them very readily. And so people are really experimenting with colour. They have much more freedom all of a sudden within a few years than they've ever had before. And this has quite a big impact on the way people think about dressing.
The fact that purple already had been coated with wealth, it already had been the colour of royalty, now it's become much more available to people through this invention. Does it change the way the colour itself is seen? Does it change the meaning of the colour?
Yes, I think you do see a loosening of that very kind of close association of wealth and power and purple. Obviously, it still lasts to this day, so it doesn't go away completely. But other meanings start rising too. So at the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century, purple and colours like mauve and lavender are really becoming associated with homosexuality. Purple and mauve and lavender were favourite colours of Oscar Wilde. He obviously is arrested and goes through this very exposing, infamous trial. You know, it's covered internationally. And purple kind of suffers as a result of that. And again, this meaning becomes encoded into purple as well. And I think that takes over for a little while, particularly with those paler purples. You really see that meaning rise at the end of the 19th and into the beginning of the 20th century.
But to this day, that association of purple and royalty, they're still kind of linked.
In almost every period drama that I've watched where you're looking at kind of a young Queen Victoria, at some point she will appear in a purple gown. And that's why we not only was it the case that people associated purple with royalty, but we still do today. And we kind of expect archetypal Victorian royals to appear at some point in purple.
So William Perkin makes his incredible discovery when he's basically just a teenager. What happens as he actually gets older?
So he works, you know, he's set up with his father and his brother this factory that's based in Harrow. And this continues for a few years. Ultimately, where his heart lies is research. And that's what he kind of moves away from the company to continue. And in fact, he's knighted in 1906. So the 50th anniversary of his discovery, he's knighted. And he is really by then part of the scientific establishment and very well respected, and sort of does speaking tours in America and so on and so forth, and is kind of lauded as an elder statesman of chemistry.
What do you think the legacy of that discovery should be? How should we regard it throughout history?
It's a really interesting one. I feel like the democratization of colour is something that is a wonderful thing. People have a greater access to colours and a greater freedom to put different colours together and different types of fabric together. So I like that. But I also, you know, this is part of this wave of discovery that really means that the textile industry becomes a lot messier and dirtier. And it also loosens the importance, I think, that people held for cloth. You really start to see, it's the start of the decline of the importance of textiles, I think, in people's lives, because suddenly you're no longer saving up for months on end to afford this particular piece of cloth. That lessens the importance and respect maybe that people have for cloth. So I feel very conflicted about it. I love the fact that we have this explosion of colour and people are so excited about it, and it leads to this great bravery and freedom. But there's also been negative consequences.
When people open up their wardrobes and pick out something purple to wear, what would you like them to think about? What would you like them to remember about Perkin and his invention?
I think even if people don't have purple in their wardrobes, even if they open up their wardrobes and see the range of colours that they have, the blues, the greens, the yellows, the pinks, the purples, the rainbow of colours, that is thanks to Perkin and his invention, because it opened the floodgates and suddenly you have this family of dyes that are created. The most positive and the thing that really sticks with me about what he did is how young he was and that confidence in his discovery. I think that's the most incredible part of it. It's the bit that I can never really wrap my head around. Every sort of internal simulation I run where it's me in his place, I think I'd have put that discovery aside and gone back to working on quinine. But the fact that he didn't, the fact that he had this entrepreneurial spirit and was just a different type of person, you know, has rewritten history and impacts all of our lives whenever we go into a clothes shop and we have this huge rainbow of options. Ultimately, it's him we have to thank.
By the way, don't think I haven't noticed that you've been wearing a purple scarf throughout this entire conversation. I've noticed. This has been an absolute delight. I will never look at my wardrobe the same way again, mostly because my wardrobe's entirely black and I will be regretting not having more purple in there. Cassia Sinclair, thank you so much for talking to us again. It's always such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, so happy to be invited back.
Cassia Sinclair is a writer, cultural historian and the author of the book, The Secret Lives of Colour. And this isn't the first time you've heard her on the podcast. The other story she told us was the incredible tale of the lingerie makers who put Neil Armstrong on the moon. If you haven't heard it, go back. We'll put it in the show notes. This episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Taryn Priadko and Zoe Ferguson on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. The sound engineer was Tim Simons. If you have a story from history that you think should be on the show, you know the deal. I say it every week. You just email us, noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back with a brand new episode next week. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.